Welcome, Venable George.
Hey guys. Nice to see you. I'm gonna try to see everyone. Here we go, gallery view. So, yeah, we have hopefully not everyone, but maybe we can begin with a little meditation while some people are joining. So, comfortably, relax your body in the presence of the Buddha and all sentient beings. I remember one of my Dharma friends, a monk whose Spanish name was Jesus, like Jesus. He was at Sarah. He used to teach Lama Ussel Spanish while I taught Lama Ussel the English subjects. Jesus was a very good meditator. He said he used to begin meditation by, like at the beginning of Lama Trungpa, imagining all sentient beings around us and seated, you know, having empathy, brotherhood and sisterhood for them. So with the thought to relax your mind, let other thoughts go. And just focus on your respiration for maybe a dozen or so cycles. Just watching it very carefully. If you had a little success with that, bring your attention to your mental consciousness. Let go of paying attention to the breathing. It'll still continue. And as before, you may have a memory of the spaciousness you began to experience. Try to focus on that, or if thoughts are present, between the thoughts, moments of quiet and clarity. Even if the thoughts are present, remembering that their very presence indicates that the mind is spacious and clear, unobstructing, in that those thoughts can appear within it and disappear. So turn your attention away from the objective thought to the spaciousness of the subjective mind within which it's appearing. Try to let go of the seemingly looming presence of your body that is appearing to your mind as a thought, as an image. Try to sense the spaciousness of the mind within which that's appearing. Even the sense of yourself as a meditator is appearing to your mind as a concept, thought. Even let that go. As you get familiar with this kind of meditation, you may have a sort of appearance to your consciousness of the consciousness, you know, sort of spacious and clear light. Even that yet is just an approximation. So kind of like an iterative process, let go of that. Try to sense the actual clarity of the mind within which your image of it is still approximating. This is our resource, our safe place. We can go to when thoughts become, you know, so problematic. Recognizing this is a special quality of having this life of leisure and endowment. We can recognize this potential within our mind to let go of all faulty states and to develop good states. Like as Robert Thurman says, reprogram the hard drive of your mind. And as yesterday, thinking not to waste this opportunity to leave an imprint in the mind, to use this life and future lives for the welfare of others, having understood a bit that the best way to do that eventually is to achieve our own higher states, culminating in enlightenment. Try to make a strong determination that I'm going to participate today for that purpose, to achieve enlightenment, not simple nirvana, but full enlightenment of a Buddha, the omniscient mind, from which state I can effortlessly and spontaneously benefit all sentient beings without any error, lead them out of samsara into eventually that same state. For that purpose, I'm going to listen, participate in the talk this morning, this afternoon rather. And then bring your attention back to present. Relax. So, any observations about the meditation or questions? No? Someone? Yeah?
George?
Yes.
Hi, this is Kondo.
Put your volume up a little bit, Venerable.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, better.
Okay. So I think I wasn't near the mic. It's about the talk last, the comments last night and the talk last night about the Buddha teaching people of lesser minds or the Hinayana vehicle versus the Mahayana. And this is just a comment that I'm not, everyone may be aware of or come to mind, but just like, and also asking if I'm inaccurate in this, okay? Just like all sentient beings have been our mothers at one time, and we have been our mothers at one time, until we've reached kind of the path of non-returning, we've all been on, have lesser minds or fuller minds in numerous times in many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I mean, that it is, somehow I feel like when people talk about lesser minds, they're talking about something that's fixed versus something that's just as impermanent, as changeable as every other is just as empty.
Yeah, I haven't used the word lesser minds, but usually in Buddhism, there's sometimes a categorization of the ability of sentient beings at any one moment to say beings of
less
faculties. Usually the faculties include different kinds of things, even your eye and so forth, but mainly it's talking about wisdom, mindfulness, and so forth. The main one is wisdom. But as you say, those are all impermanent, and even at any one time, our predisposition to practice different things is temporary, such as even the individuals that have predisposition to want to practice the Shravakayana or the Pratika Buddhayana, means the paths that lead to nirvana, that eventually will change once they have some, you know, if they achieve that state and they remain in it for a very, very long time, they will be awakened by the Buddhas and they will be energized to come back and practice the Mahayana path. So all those things, yeah, all those things are temporary. And even if we might think of ourselves as, you know, lower quality now. Oh, I can't do that or something like that. We don't know what we have, what instincts are on our mind stream that can be awakened by listening to the teachings. Sometimes just meditating on the teachings can bring about a big transformation in our experience. And someone who looks very meager at one point can actually become a supreme practitioner of that same life. Many examples in the Kadampa
tradition.
Geshe's, you know, the tradition. The Geshe Benguigal, who was sort of like this rascally guy who was, you know, very lazy and so forth. He at first, so many negative thoughts coming, he trained himself to put a black pebble down on his table every time he had negative thoughts and a white pebble every time he had a virtuous thought. And at the beginning, you know, many days, the whole table was filled with black pebbles, maybe no or one white pebble. But eventually, by training the mind, he was able to change that and became a great practitioner. So, yeah. One thing I wanted to mention about yesterday, Sister Donna had forwarded me a comment that someone had made about that that question about the Hinayana and Mahayana. I don't see him here right now. I'm not sure. Maybe he was here. I can't remember what his name was. And he said, there are great teachers in the Theravada who teach and help others endlessly. I disagree with Buddha. And then he had a smiley face at the end. So I didn't say that the Buddha didn't say that there were great teachers in the Theravada. Obviously, the Buddha taught what is now called the Theravada, what we could call the generally called the Hinayana. That was his teaching to the main disciples at the time, because they were the ones that were ripe. They had the instinct to have the energy, energized by the example of the Buddha, to achieve nirvana, get out of this mess. And many of them were great teachers and inspiration to others. Some of them, like the 16 arhats, you may have heard, we do prayers sometimes to the 16, actually they're called the 16 staiviras, the 16 elders. They were, you know, the elder, some of the elder arhats, and they had made very, incredible devotion to Buddhism and the teachings. They made sort of aspirational prayers that their influence would, help to perpetuate the Dharma. Some of them actually became bodhisattvas. Maybe some of them were actually bodhisattvas at the time, masquerading as arhats, which you can sometimes do. You know, like if you go to a rally, you might actually be able to quell the disturbed minds of people by manifesting as being one of them at first, but giving some sage advice, and it's kind of like that. So, Lama Yeshe used to say, it's a little, the if you think about it, the difference between the goal of the Hinayana path and the Mahayana path. Hinayana path, the main goal is to get out of samsara for yourself, like that famous song, I got to get out of this place, right? What was that? Not the Doors, or who was it?
The Animals.
The Animals, there you go. Yeah, we talked about that other years. So sort of like the Hinayana view is, I've got to get out of this place. The Mahayana view is, we've got to get out of this place. So you're helping to lead others out of it. So it's a little bit like being at a cocktail party or a pool party, and you're imbibing beer or whatever your choice of intoxicant is. Beautiful people, you know, nice Raleigh summer night, and someone hands you a phone, and it's your mother saying, I'm trapped in the house. It's on fire. Please come and help me. And you're enjoying yourself so much, you kind of look at the phone, you look at all the enjoyments around you, and you put the phone down and say, later. You know, as you know, that your own enjoyment is paramount. So to actually develop the mind of the Mahayana, which these eight verses are emphasizing, you know, different practices to bring about, is although we might consider ourselves Mahayanists in tenets, you know, in philosophy, maybe we're not even Mahayanists, we're not Mahayanists in practice. Maybe some of the Theravada practitioners are more Mahayana in practice. That is to say, they have great compassion and work for others as the individual who had asked that question was kind of implying. So that's definitely possible. So let me continue a little bit here on the next verse. We finished two. So the third verse is, according to Lama Zopa Rinpoche's translation, which some of you have, in all actions, I examine my mental continuum, and the minute a delusion arises, since it endangers myself and others, I forcefully confront and avert it. I don't know if this was Rinpoche's choice of grammar. I would think, you know, I will, or I instead of saying I examine. One of the translations that we used to have was vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions. Whenever a delusion, an affliction arises, endangering myself and others, I will confront and avert it without delay. Immediately confront and avert it. So that gets, those two translations get more or less the same same flavor. You can kind of edit the verses yourself as long as you have the essential important points in it. So this verse is talking about one of the essential practices of introspection, watching your mind, because all of our activities are controlled by our mind. If you begin to watch your mind, you notice that your reactions to situations, your verbal and physical reactions, and of course your mental reactions, all depend upon how you're looking at it. Whether there are faulty states of mind that are present, causing you to think and act in ways that are not profitable to you, that are negative, that create negative imprints in our minds, negative karma. So it's the practice of the bodhisattvas and the practice of also the Theravada to observe one's own mind, even when you're walking, when you're washing the dishes, you're driving, not to the distraction of, you know, crashing into another car, but to be aware of your mind and to be vigilant of the arisal of disturbing states. What we can summarize all of the different kinds of disturbing states. The Buddha said that there were something like 84,000 afflictions. We can summarize them all into three, what are called the three poisonous minds. I think we talked before. The most destructive of which are the set out of those 84,000 compressed into one segment called angered repulsion, sort of things where you've experienced something that's you find unpleasant, and as a result of that, you project upon the situation faults that are not really there. maybe on the situation or the person who's causing the problem or the government or whatever, or your bad luck, whatever you might feel, anger or the whole myriad of tendrils of similar kinds of minds that want to strike out and push it away, something that's impinged upon your ego sphere, if you'll accept the, let me use my own lingo there, instead of the ecosphere, your ego sphere, something which is threatening, and so you want to push it out. That's one set of the delusions that can be comprised in the poisonous mind of anger or hatred. Then another kind is when you've experienced something which pleasant and you want to have it, you like to bring it toward into your ego sphere, are things that we call attachments or desire. And because of feeling something pleasant, that's more difficult to see as a problem. The anger and repulsion, the first poisonous mind, or well, you can put them in any order, but the ones that are want to have things out of your ego sphere, the ones that are like attachment are more difficult to recognize as problematic. Sometimes we think of them, well, sometimes we even think of anger as our ally, as I mentioned sometime before, but it's more difficult to see the disadvantages of attachment. And the third set, I don't have three hands, unfortunately. The third set is what we call, we could generally call bewilderment. The predominant kind of bewilderment is ignorance or ego grasping and other kinds of ignorance. So these three, what are called the three poisons, that means the three poisonous minds, three kinds of afflictions. So this is what we want to be able to recognize. As Rinpoche says, I examine my mental continuum, or in the translation, I think we used to have something like this, vigilant of my mind stream. Here it says mental continuum, means the same thing, right? The continuity of your mental consciousness. So watching that, and in the sense that as soon as something occurs within it, one of these poisonous minds that you can begin to recognize after some time, so the example here is, what do you do if that happens? What you want to do is first recognize it, and that takes, in order to do that, you have to know the defining characteristics of those afflictive states of mind, what we call delusions or afflictions. The Sanskrit word you may have heard is klesha. Have you heard that word? So in the Four Noble Truths, when we talk about the truth, the origin of suffering, there's the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering. The origin of suffering is twofold, karma and klesha, or actions and delusions. When we create negative actions, negative karma, that leaves an imprint in our mind that is the like the seed that can give a sprout of suffering in the future. What causes us to create those actions is a more fundamental cause of them. Even if you stop the actions, if you don't eliminate the imprints in your mind of the delusions, the afflictions, the klesha, so even if you purify all the negative karma that you've created, you still have the seeds of delusions in your mind, either active or just in potential state. If you haven't eliminated them, they will arise again in certain circumstances, in this lifetime, future lifetimes. Even you do a Vajrasattva retreat and purify tremendous amount of negative karma, as soon as you get out of the retreat, maybe you feel pride. You go to the tea shop in Kathmandu or something after the Kopan course, and you get angry or something like that and create new negative karma. So here we're dealing, this verse is talking about watching the klesha, watching the arisal of the afflictions. So vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions. So that means whether you're, usually they talk about four kinds of trilam, that means it, paths of action, sort of that means standing, walking, sitting or sleeping. You could say that all of the physical activities can be included in that. I suppose playing baseball, what are you, you're doing, you're walking and standing. If you're at your, in Robbie's office, you're sitting and standing, you know, different things. So whatever you're doing, part of your mind is obviously attending to the activity that you're doing, whether you're washing the dishes or whatever. And there are ways of thinking in that, you know, like as you clean the dishes, thinking, like this, may I clean the delusions from the minds of all sentient beings. So ways of thinking of in that, but always vigilant of your continuum, your mental continuum, if delusions are arising. Because delusions are problematic for ourself and for others. In the case of just getting angry at the wall, maybe others aren't immediately impacted by that unless they live in the room next to us and they hear us pounding on it, pounding on the wall. But many of our delusions, they impact others when we get angry, when we have great attachment and clinging, when we act out of jealousy or pride or whatever, they impact others, they harm others, their peace of mind. But for us, they create incredible havoc. You know, our mind, say for instance, if we get angry, we know, we don't really, although we may relish the experience of release of the anger when you let it out. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes we feel you've got to get it out, and you feel some relief. But in so doing, we create negative karma. We say harsh words. We strike out. We might hurt others. We may affect relationships that we have created over a long period of time with great care and effort can be sort of undermined in just a few harsh words. So, well, first of all, we have to recognize by having studied what these, the qualities or the faults of these, the defining characteristics, let's say, of these afflictions are. Generally, attachment arises as a result of experiencing something pleasant. Our mind then exaggerates the qualities of that immediately, whether it be on the super fundamental level of seeing it as inherently existing, the source of that pleasure, or, you know, oh, that person's such a nice face, such, oh, they have, they're saying nice things about me, they like me, you know, exaggerating the qualities so that you want to keep it, or if you don't have it, to get it, to preserve it, and so forth. Anger, on the other hand, starts from something that's unpleasant, exaggerating the faults of that in different ways, thinking, you know, the fault lies in the other person. It's their fault. They said this harsh word to me, or that I've been bumped. Not recognizing the karmic evolution of it, that it's whatever harm you're experiencing, unpleasant experience that you have has arisen because of your past karma, and the present situation is just a cooperative condition. Exaggerating the faults of that, wanting to push, you know, have it away from you, either avoiding it, what is called flight or fight, you know, flight away or pushing it away, you know, trying to prevent it. Ignorance generally is sort of the intermediary between those, the bewilderment in general, not developing thoughts of anger or attachment, but still perpetuating unknowing, which is whenever you are in a situation where you don't understand something fully, as the Dalai Lama says, if you don't know that your neighbor is, every night is moving the fence a couple of inches onto your, the boundary between your houses, is moving it every night, oblivious of that, you can fall into problems. So this is a basic kind of practice of the mind training, because what even you're trying to cherish others, as in the first verse, always to recognize the value of cherishing them, in that it brings you closer to enlightenment. You create all of the causes of good quality. And even in the second verse, if you recognize the faults of pride and hold yourself low and hold others as superior, cherish them as superior to you, other kinds of delusions can arise. So you want to be vigilant. So the classic example, I remember the first time I received this teaching from Lama Sopa Rinpoche at Kopan, I think it was 1974. You may have heard this example also. The expression I use, confront and avert them, and that's what Lama Sopa Rinpoche says here, I forcefully confront and avert them. I will confront and avert them without delay. It's a little bit like this, like in the entryway to the king's chamber, the throne room or something. There are guards outside, there are two guards on either side with spears. And so if someone comes up, they first, if they recognize it's not one of the ministers, not the wife or the children or something, so they confront them. Who are you? Investigate. And if it is found having investigated, confronting them, if they recognize that there's some danger, they will avert them. They take their spears and they immediately get the person away. They threaten them, they push them away so they don't get in. So that's kind of the idea here. You might notice some, if you're very observant, you can notice the maybe irritation building in your mind, like bubbles in the bottom of a boiling vessel of water starting to rise, before they hit the surface, before the anger actually arises. You can notice irritation and your mind is becoming disturbed. One of the general characteristics of all of the afflictions is that the mind becomes like the surface of a agitated water, is not calm, and also becomes unclear. Like if the horses run through a riverbed, crossing the river, the king's horses, their hooves not only cause the water to be agitated, but also the mud to be injected back into the water. Their hooves, dig into the mud as they're running through so the water becomes murky and agitated. That's kind of like the characteristic of all of the delusions. So if you begin to note that, you have to, it's not just enough to note that, but you have to avert that. You have to confront means, in this sense, means to recognize it and, put some guard up. And then to avert it means to apply the antidotes to those afflictive states of mind. Applying the antidotes, there are, by antidote, I don't mean, a cup of chamomile tea or some ginseng or something like that, or a cigarette or whatever you might have, a shot of whiskey or whatever. Antidote here means the mental antidote to overcome those states of mind. For instance, if you're, it is a fact of consciousness that if one state of mind is present, such as anger, the polar opposite of that, such as love and compassion, can't be present at that time. The mind can only hold one aspect, you know, something unpleasant. Whereas if you can, first of all, reduce your that strong effect of the delusion, hopefully because you've caught it early enough and it's not caught hold of your mind, you can actually inject the opposite state of mind, actually meditate on love and compassion, and prevent the anger from actually rising. I think I mentioned at Kadampa Center in the past, and I think I mentioned in the talks I gave in New York and Washington last weekend on the 37 practices, or was it the weekend before that? The Kadampa Geshe's had four, say for instance, with respect to anger, they had four methods. We talked about this before, the four Kadampa methods to deal with anger. Do you remember this? Donna, yeah, you're nodding partially. Kind of remember. So they talked about the arrow in the target. Which is essentially talking about karma. If you haven't created the karma in the past, like having shot the arrow, there's no way that it could hit the target now. That is to say, whatever situation is arising right now, whatever cooperative condition is like putting up a target, if you hadn't created the karma in the past, in this analogy, like shooting the arrow, there's no way that the karma could ripen now in something unpleasant. So instead of thinking of the other person as being the major cause of your suffering, think they're just like a cooperative condition. If I hadn't created the karma for this in the past, there's no way that I could be experiencing this abuse or harm or, you know, something unpleasant. Maybe they have bad breath or body odor or whatever you find unpleasant. There's no way that you could experience this unless you created the karma in the past. So that helps to diffuse the situation which is instigating the anger. You know, it starts to, you start to recognize it's not the other person's fault, it's my fault. My previous karma that I created, generally previous lives. Very rare that negative karma will ripen in the very same life. Maybe it has to be super heavy. What do people talk? Sometimes people talk about instant karma. Do you ever hear people say that, kids? You abuse someone, and then the next day your car is keyed. Is that the term they're using when someone puts their key along the panes of your car? Someone would say instant karma, or maybe even more instant. You hit someone and they hit you back. Generally, what you're experiencing is in situations like that is you create a cooperative condition with your negative action now that insults someone else. The karma that you've created won't ripen until a future life, but in so doing, you've created a cooperative condition for your own negative karma to ripen. So at any rate, what you want to be able to do is to apply the antidotes to these various afflictions. So arrow in the target is one way to deal with anger. Another is compassion. Rather than thinking that the other person is suitable to be harmed, or they needed that. Is that, I remember sometime coming, when I came back to the States and watched some television, there was this expression when you got angry at someone in a soap opera or someone, and someone said, oh, you shouldn't have gotten angry with them. And the person would say, oh, they needed that, as though they somehow were deserving, you know, of that harm or that correction of their behavior. To think we, use yourself as an example, sort of equalizing yourself and others, recognize how even when we do something wrong or bad, we'd like others to say, oh, that's okay, don't worry about it. You know, you spill ink on your grandma's Persian carpet or something, and, you know, you're afraid you're going to be disinherited or something, and she says, oh, that's okay, it needed to be cleaned anyway, you know, something like that. That's how we would like to feel. So to put yourself, if you can equalize yourself and others, to think, that's how we should behave with others, out of compassion for them, or remembering, recognizing their kindness and having been our mother, our friend in numberless lifetimes in the past, wanting them not to suffer, to, you know, to develop compassion for them rather than they're suitable to be harmed. They're, you know, it's right. They needed that, or something, you know, some rationale like that, to have an opposite state of mind to help to prevent another aspect of the anger. So there are different ways you can look at it. So arrow in the target, which means karma, compassion. Another is to recognize the person as giving you an opportunity to practice patience. That they are, in a sense, your spiritual guide, your guru. Rather than thinking, this is something I don't need, which is, you know, when you're ready to strike out, to think it's something I do need. It's my teacher. It's giving me the opportunity to practice patience, compassion, to burn up my negative karma without me responding with anger. That's a win-win situation. The negative karma goes down and you don't create any new negative karma. In fact, you create some virtue in being patient. Arrow in the target is karma, compassion, guru. And then the fourth one that the Kadampa Geshe is mentioning is wisdom. So you can think of it as two parts. Wisdom of impermanence. Generally, when we talk about wisdom, we mean the wisdom of emptiness. But here we can break it into conventional wisdom. Wisdom, the perfect conventional wisdom is the wisdom of impermanence, realizing this too will pass. You know, I was thinking earlier, I have a couple of flies up in my loft here where I'm talking to you. And I was thinking during this talk, I might have a Mike Pence moment. You know, one of the flies would come on and I'd get, you know, I might swipe at it or something. I remember, actually, when I did retreat at Copan one time, we were doing, a White Tara retreat. And I had a lot of mosquitoes and flies in the room. And I tried to shoo them out and board up all of the holes they could come in, but there was always someone who got in. And I remember sitting and one fly was walking on my face and I was feeling irritated and I recognized, why is this fly here now? It must have some karmic relationship with me. Maybe this is my mother from previous life. In fact, my mom had died some years before. It might be my mom. And at that moment, thinking that, the whole situation changed. Instead of feeling irritated as this little thief walking, you know, oh, walk a little, there's some more grease over there. You know, go here, stay longer. So this is you know, this is sort of feeling of empathy and compassion, but also recognizing it as your guru, you know, giving you a chance to do this, and recognizing that this will pass also, that any kind of situation that you find unbearable is changing in the smallest moment. Even if you think someone is your enemy, reacting with kindness and understanding and humility, they may become your friend in the next moment. But the other aspect of wisdom is the wisdom of emptiness. If you can recognize that there's no inherently existing irritation, there's no inherently existing person, myself, who's experiencing this, there's no inherently existing harm, this can diffuse that also. So there are other antidotes to attachment and to all of the different afflictions. So these are what you have to study. You can know them through reading and studying the stages of the path, the Lam Rim, and the Buddhist teachings in general. If you're perceptive, almost every single sutra, or you know, even the actual sutras, the Buddha discourses the Buddha gave, or stories, you can find something that is for yourself a teaching of how to overcome afflicted states of mind. There are 84,000 different remedies to the 84,000 delusions. That's why the Buddha is said to have taught 84,000 Dharma skandhas, you know, Dharma teachings, and the 84,000 remedies to the 84,000 delusions. So vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions, whenever afflictions arise that endanger myself and others, I will confront and avert them without delay, not procrastinating, not just being, you know, spellbound by them or intimidated by them, recognizing that the inner enemies are your own delusions. They are the real enemies. The outer enemies, even if you defeat them right now, you say harsh words, you humiliate them, they can come back and harm you. Whereas the inner enemies, if you can avert them, their intensity decreases and their frequency of arising decreases. You know, you can train yourself to overcome anger and attachment and so forth. Eventually, if you can apply the antidote of realization of emptiness, you can cause them to be eradicated so they'll never come back. But the real enemies are the inner afflictions. So that's what this verse is talking about. So vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions, whatever I do, always part of your mind watching your mental consciousness, your mental continuum. Whenever afflictions arise, endangering myself and others, I will confront and avert them without delay. So I like to think sometimes when I lay down to sleep or take a nap or rest, I sort of daydream. I think, oh, it'd be so nice to play the piano, or, you know, to be a famous. One fantasy I have is to be a detective, high-tech detective, you know, that solves all the problems and helps people or something. Or sometimes, you know, your mind may daydream of something, having friends or relationships or something like this. Rather than that, I like to think, watching that in my mind, because oftentimes these have to do with pride or, attachment or getting back at the enemy. Or at one time when I had some people attacking in a certain sense, I would have daydreams about escaping, you know, like going out and living in the secret in the forest and foraging for myself, you know, all of these things are just enhancing those delusions. Rather than that, imagine when you sit down, imagine meditating. Imagine the peace of mind that you can develop that you may have experienced occasionally through, you know, having some insights into the Dharma and your ability to help others like that. Okay? That's the third verse. How are we doing? So, again, if you have any questions as we're going along, you okay with that? There's more that could be said, but okay. So next verse, verse 4. Lama Zopa Rinpoche's translation says, whenever I see sentient beings who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by negative actions and heavy suffering, I will hold such rare ones dear as if I had found a precious treasure. Oh, yeah, he leaves out this, the last line is newa kewa, which means difficult to find. I don't see that in his translation. Whenever I see sentient beings who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by negative actions and heavy suffering, I hold such rare ones dear as if I had found a precious treasure. So it's just leaving out that phrase. Other translations do have this difficult to acquire. I think Thupten Jinpa's translation of this verse has that, adds that flavor there, which is, this is verse 4. So he translates it like this. When I encounter beings of unpleasant character, Rinpoche says, wicked in nature, unpleasant character, and those oppressed by intense negative karma and suffering, Rinpoche says, overwhelmed by negative actions and heavy suffering, as though finding a treasure of precious jewels, having found a precious treasure, I will train myself to cherish them, for they are so rarely found. The way I usually, my own daily translation of this is, whenever I meet beings of bad character, so the word rangshin here often colloquial means, it can mean nature, but it also talks about one's character. When I meet beings of bad character, oppressed by suffering and obsessed with negative actions, there's a verb in Tibetan here that's applying to both. It's kind of like oppressed, overwhelmed. Here, Rinpoche says, overwhelmed by negative actions and heavy suffering. Thupten Jinpa says, oppressed by these. But in a sense, the same verb might be different in English for the two things. So you could say, oppressed by great suffering, you know, excruciating, you know, experiencing great suffering, like leprosy or humiliation or, you know, all sorts of loss, and obsessed by negative actions. That means not just oppressed by them, that means, you know, what was it, the Glenn Close, what was it, the, remember the movie? You guys aren't cineophiles. Robbie Watkins, you watch movies? You don't watch movies, you just read cookbooks.
Fatal Attraction.
Fatal Attraction, yeah. So, you know, obsessed with negative actions. Whenever I encounter beings of bad character, oppressed by great suffering and obsessed with negative actions, I will cherish them as a precious treasure that is difficult to find. So the the phrase difficult to find has special significance here because if we deal with sane people, unlike the political situation in the States today, if you deal with sane people, you know, in your friends, everyone, you know, that has a loving concern and so forth, it's very difficult to practice patience when everyone takes care of you and whatever you do is kind of forgiven, or they might chide you a little bit, you know, for your bad behavior, but you're forgiven. What's really, in terms of our practice, though, we never have a chance to practice patience. What you really need is something that the bodhisattvas search for, because the bodhisattvas have such great a store of virtuous karma, they very rarely encounter beings that are negative toward them. So if they see the opportunity, if something like that arises, they because it's so rare and it's so valuable, like a precious treasure, because it gives them a chance to practice patience, they hold on to that. Does it make sense? Yeah. So example that I've given in other courses also, if Diana, I think, listened in Washington, I gave this in the 37 practices also. There was one monk at Copan when I was there. We used to, he was named as the disciplinarian of the monks. There was another nun who was named as a disciplinarian of the nuns. And so he was, you know, he was a little bit zealous, is often the case when you become the disciplinarian at the monasteries. And I remember him coming around in the morning. We were memorizing Abhidharma Kosha, which is like I was mentioning yesterday about learning the words. It's like putting up stones, a stone fence, and that's like memorizing the root text of these great the great Indian classics, memorizing them. And then when you hear the commentary, it's like putting the mortar or mud between them that makes it solidified and helps you to be able to connect the meaning with the words. So we were memorizing, and I was very excited. I was the only one there all the time memorizing. And I remember him coming early in the morning, before the memorization class, and coming and checking the people's room. And he came in my room and said, you know, you better go to the memorization. If you don't go, you're not getting lunch. I thought this must have been a threat that his father, he's sort of like kind of threat, you know, you can't play with your iPad, or you're not getting dessert or something like that if you're bad. And it was so uncalled for. And he was very much like this, you know, a little bit rough around the edges. And the other Sangha also felt he was a bit of an object of patience. And so it was almost like, would be nice if he wasn't around as the disciplinarian any longer. At a certain point, Lama Yeshe asked him to go to, I think, Australia, to one of the centers in Australia, to be a program coordinator there. And our first response was one of relief. Oh, wow. Finally, you know, some peace. But then it dawned on me and others that we were missing something now. We had, at that time, we had a constant source of patience. And we almost now regretted his absence. So this is a little bit of the flavor here. Whenever I meet beings of bad character, oppressed by great suffering and obsessed with the negative actions, I will cherish them as a precious treasure because they're difficult to acquire. Generally, we don't have that many opportunities to practice patience. Now, maybe you're going to say, oh, no, I got plenty. Well, you might actually think if that is the case, You might think of yourself as quite lucky from the spiritual point of view, because at this particular lifetime, you're experiencing a situation that can be transformed. One of the guiding principles of the mind transformation, training of the mind, Lojong, is how to transform adverse conditions into the path. What that means is, instead of them being seen, you know, the irritation, adverse condition, right? You might think that's preventing me from practicing, to transform it into something that actually enhances your practice, seeing it as an opportunity to practice patience. Like I also gave an example when we talk about single point of concentration. If you've set up your meditation retreat for the weekend, you're going to try to develop single point of concentration. And right that time, just when you're sitting down, your neighbor decides to blow the leaves. You know, with these huge, I don't know, do they make a lot of sound in your, some of them make a lot of sound, or they're cutting the grass right next to your lawn, right next to your window, or they're chopping a tree, or a motorcycle is, the guy's tuning the engine of his motorcycle in the, you know, something. So instead of getting angry, you can use that opportunity, because it's not going to last forever. You can use that opportunity to think, oh, this is giving me now a chance to really bring my attention inward. This is okay. Whenever I encounter beings of bad character, yeah, maybe we can think of some politicians like that right now. I'm not making any, they're both sides have some, but there might maybe some that are a little more problematic character who are experiencing great suffering. Maybe they feel humiliated or, you know, entitled or whiny or whatever, and create and obsessed with negative actions, putting other people down and so forth. Instead of letting your mind just get completely bananas, to recognize this is an opportunity to develop compassion for them, because a situation, such an almost absurd situation like this is almost unheard of in our lifetimes, you know, such blatant kind of behavior. Okay, make sense? Let me read you a little bit from Geshe Sonam Rinchen's commentary on this verse. So he translates it, he prefaces this verse by saying, Geshe Langri Tangba, so that's the author of the eight verses, remember? One of the Kadampa Geshes, who was, along with Potawa, were the main, they called them the sun and the moon, disciples of Drondemba, who was the main disciple of Atisha. So Geshe Langri Tangba suggests another way of dealing with provocative situations that cause the disturbing emotions to arise. In our normal everyday life, we cannot avoid meeting people who are very difficult. When trying to forget about ourselves and cherish others, the kind of seclusion that we must seek in such situations is not to isolate ourselves physically, but to distance ourselves from self-preoccupation and self-interest. So not to isolate ourselves, but to isolate our mind from our own self-interest, self-cherishing, and so forth. So he translates it this way. When I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by wrongdoing and pain, may I cherish them as something rare. You know, rare. This is difficult to find, rare. As though I had found a treasure trove. When faced with ill-natured people, we should think about the fact that in the past, they failed to see the harmfulness of the disturbing emotions which now overwhelm them. They became accustomed to giving them full rein, and this familiarity is carried over into their present life. Nor can they have created much positive energy. All of this accounts for their unpleasant conduct. So we can think of the same when we, in the previous verse, when we talked about observing our own mind. If we get used to the delusions, if we give them full rein, it's what the Dalai Lama calls meditating on the delusions or rehearsing the delusions. I remember Richard Gere, you've heard, you know, Richard Gere, the movie star, he was telling us once that he told the Dalai Lama about how sometimes in acting you had to get into the character, maybe an angry state of mind and so forth. And he said the Dalai Lama counseled him not to get carried away, because it's kind of like rehearsing the delusions. You kind of give your mind permission to have that kind of state of mind. You know, when we talk about the causes of the afflictions, one of them is familiarizing the mind with the afflictions. You know what the causes of the delusions are? You know, Mario, what are the six causes of the delusions?
I don't know that I have them all memorized. I'm familiar with the concept. Sorry.
Do you know some of them?
I don't know right now. Sorry.
Oh, I thought you were nodding your head. Does anyone know? So maybe I'll mention a little bit. So the first cause is having the imprint in the mind for the delusion. So it's like the predisposition. It may be dormant. The delusion's not present, but you have the potential. Even right now, none of us are angry, unless I'm mistaking your facial appearances. None of us are overly attached or jealous or proud. But we have certainly, because we have the imprint in our mind for that delusion, when the right conditions arise, it can come. So that's the first cause. Who doesn't have the imprints of the delusions? Someone who has realized emptiness directly. At that point, we abandon the imprints of certain delusions, and the more and more we meditate on direct realization of emptiness, more and more of the imprints of the delusions are eradicated, until we reach in the Bodhisattva path, we reach the end of the seventh bhumi, the beginning of the eighth bhumi, and we have eliminated all of the imprints of the delusions from our mind. So they won't arise again. So like the arhats, if they've actually achieved nirvana and become an arhat, they no longer have the imprints of the delusions. So that's one cause. Second cause is the coming in contact with the object of our delusions. So if you are like ordinary beings, if you see something attractive, because you have the imprint in your mind for attachment to arise, coming in contact with the object of attachment, a handsome person, a beautiful person, new car, you know, the new Apple silicon iPad or whatever it is, attachment can rise. So the object, so that's why we try to live in seclusion to a certain degree, to seclude ourselves from going to the discotheque or to what is it called? Where do the people who fight the dogs, what is that called? You know, they have dog fights and people crowd, or boxing matches in the basement of some garage or something like that, and everyone's, all your anger and everything. You avoid situations. That's just giving extreme examples. But if you can avoid, if you're alcoholic, you want to try to avoid bars, right? and so forth. And then another one is, another cause of the delusions is inappropriate attention. Sushin mayimbe yila cheba, into that end. That means thinking about the objects in the wrong way, rather than thinking, oh, this attractive object is impermanent and it will not lead to real satisfaction. That's called appropriate attention. Inappropriate attention is saying, wow, that is really nice. You know, thinking about it and enhancing your superimposition on it of qualities that it doesn't really have. Three. Another one is familiarity. That's like what we're talking about here. Being familiar with the delusions so that even it's not present right now, with the slightest stimulus, you know, someone of angry nature, we say, oh, they're kind of easily angered. Because they're familiar with that this lifetime, not applying antidotes to it. Okay, how many is that? Is that three or four? Three? Oh, you got four. Object, instinct, oh, four. Okay, instinct, object, inappropriate attention, familiarity. Then,
add friends.
Yeah, I'm going there. That's the next one. You get it, just which order. The next one is it's called negative friends or bad friends. That means even though they may not be someone who is inciting you into bad behavior necessarily, but they're just saying, oh, while you're sitting here meditating, we could be out at the ball game. Why are you studying? Why are you spending so much time doing this? Or it can be people that incite you into bad behavior because of their own bad behavior. You hang around with them long enough and you start smoking or drinking or swearing or, you know, having bad behavior. And then the sixth one is what's called, bad stimulus in terms of traditionally they would say reading literature, you know, romantic novels or what would be for teenage boys, you know, Playboy or you know, nowadays pornography or something like that, or reading war stories or listening to Fox News. I don't know, you know, all kinds of things that can cause your anger or your attachment or your resentment or, you know, negative states of mind to rise. Those are called the six causes of the delusions. So here. Go on.
I want to interrupt. There's a question in chat and a student has her hand up.
Okay.
Okay. The question in chat is, isn't judging someone as evil like meditation on the delusion? Are we not to apply the antidote to our afflictive mental attitude?
Can you say again?
Isn't judging someone as evil like meditation on the delusion? And then the second part, are we not to apply the antidote to our afflictive mental, well, she said antidote, I'm not sure if she meant antidote or attitude. She clarified, afflictive mental reaction. Are we not to apply the antidote to our afflictive mental reaction?
Well, here, the verse that maybe that's the one you're talking about. Whenever we encounter beings of bad character who are experiencing, oppressed by great suffering and obsessed by negative actions, that's not, you might think that's a judgment call or that's being judgmental or it's causing your own delusion to arise. To recognize reality, if people are, from a Buddhist perspective, creating negative karma and they are
experiencing great suffering, that's something that you can observe and you can feel compassion for. And that's what's meant in this verse, to feel some empathy and compassion for them rather than being judgmental and running away and so forth, even though you'd like to. So I'm not quite sure, maybe if that person wants to elaborate a little bit more in another chat to you, but let me read a little bit more, and we're going to take a break in the middle here because it's almost 2:30. So maybe in 5 minutes we'll take a 10-minute break for bathroom, tea, Coca-Cola, whatever. They became accustomed to giving them full rein, their delusions, and this familiarity is carried over into their present life. So that's one of the causes of that and something we should be aware of. There are so many people who are ungrateful for the kindness which others show them. Imagine you have cooked a delicious meal for a sick friend and you bring it to her. In her haste to eat, she takes a big mouthful and burns her tongue. Angrily, she pushes the plate away, or worse, throws it on the ground. Such bad manners are so ungrateful. Our normal reaction would be to feel angered and swear never to do anything for her again. Many people indulge their disturbing emotions and do nothing to curb them. They don't see anything wrong with expressing them. It is as if they are running around stark naked without the clothing of self-respect and decency. So this is sort of like, I think, Ruth was, this is in Geshe Sonam Rinchen's commentary, she's kind of giving a contemporary example of the classic case that's mentioned in the commentary, and Geshe Chekhova's commentary to the 8 verses, talking about someone who, going over a mountain pass, very cold, exhausted in Tibet, and you offer them out of kindness, a plate of hot stew, you know, but in their eagerness to eat it, they burn their lips and they toss it down. So she's elaborating on that with the present situation. There are people who commit horrifying ill deeds, such as the 5 extremely grave and 5 almost as grave negative actions. You know, what we call the 5 actions of immediate retribution. Sometimes in the past they called them the 5 heinous actions. Actually, it's 5 actions of immediate retribution. That means they're so grave, that so heavy, that in the next life you will immediately experience the ripening of them, like drawing blood from the Buddha or causing schism in the Sangha and so forth. There are others who have broken their ordination vow as a monk or nun, but still shamelessly make private use of what belongs to the spiritual community. This has always been considered very wrong. In a secular context, a similarly serious action would be to appropriate monetary donations or things given to an aid organization and use them for private purposes. Ooh, it sounds like something, one of the political things is happening now. Anyway. Let's take a little break, 10-minute break. It's according to my watch, it's about 2:25, so we'll say 2:35. 10 minutes from now, we'll start up again. So I'm just going to stop my video, but I can leave it on. Is that right, Donna? I can leave the computer on as it is. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
See you in 10 minutes.
Okay.
So Sister Donna reminded me my papers were brushing across the microphone. Sorry about that. I'll try to be more vigilant. Either you or someone else had mentioned this to me before. I have to find some better way of holding up these papers. Okay, while we're waiting, if there's anyone else coming, I'm not sure if everyone's here. Maybe this is all that we had. But any questions so far?
I had a question, Venerable George.
Yeah, who's that?
It's Neely.
Raise your hand. I don't see. Oh, there you go. There you go.
My question was with the six causes of delusion. So like number five, negative or bad friends. So is the point of knowing what the causes are so we can be mindful of not letting it influence our mind? Because when I heard that, I'm thinking, oh, well, then we should avoid negative or bad friends. And I'm thinking, well, but that's contrary to kind of what the fourth verse says, because it says when we meet, like you said, people who are of bad character, oppressed by great suffering, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
We should try to look at that as an opportunity to practice to use our practice.
Right.
So it's not necessarily, it's just to help us be mindful of these sources to guard our mind, to better guard our mind.
Right. And also not to fall under the influence of their behavior. The classic example, I'm not sure if I mentioned here before, the two friends in Tibet, buddies when they were young. One of them had a lot of bad habits. He smoked, he drank, and he gambled. The Tibetan point of view is bad stuff. Swore, did I say that? And the other one was kind of very good-natured and maybe raised by parents that were, you know, kept him on a short leash or whatever. So at a certain point, one of them, the one who had been quite naughty, you know, gambled and everything, he went off for a year to Reading, not like the Reading Railroad in Monopoly, but R-E-T-I-N-G, the monastery of the Kadampa Geshes up in, I think, Tembo, north of Lhasa. And the cedar trees, beautiful. All the people were disciples of Atisha, Drandempa, Potawa, Langritamba, you know, all very, you know, wonderful. So in his time there, he, in association with these noble beings, he gave up drinking and gambling and swearing and all of these things, smoking. And the other one, who had been quite good, had gone to Lhasa, the capital. What is that, like Sin City, like New York or something, Broadway or whatever. Not Broadway, was it Times Square, something like that. And so there in the night, he would go to the houses, the dens, and he would gamble, and then he picked up smoking and drinking and swearing and everything. So after some time, they came together again, and, you know, the association with the different friends had affected their behavior. In one case, detrimentally, the guy who had been pretty straight arrow had become picked up these bad habits, and the one who had been rather naughty had reformed and become good. So that's kind of the sense of bad friends, not to be influenced by them. So if you have for years hung out with your high school buddies and girlfriends, you know, and some of them have gotten into, I don't know, what are they, drinking or snorting, whatever people snort, and, you know, if you hang out with them and you don't guard your mind, well, even if you try to guard your mind, just by being with them and befriending them all the time, hanging with them, you can start picking up those habits. So that's one of the, just by association, and seemingly, you know, to, you know, says, oh, come on, have a drink. Come on. Was it Neely? What was your name?
Neely.
Neely. Yes. Come on, Neely. Just one line of Coke. just one drink or one, something like this, you know, or, so out of your affection for them, you can start to pick up those habits. That's kind of like that can instigate one of the causes of the delusions.
Okay.
That makes sense?
It does. It does.
It doesn't mean that you no longer associate with them at all, but you don't hang out all the time in such a situation where they could affect your behavior like that.
Okay. And likewise with verse 4, we should use that as kind of a guide to train our mind to not avoid negative people or people who have this type of character. Not seek them out and hang out with them, but if they come across your path, like, you know, you go to a family gathering and there's one relative who's like this, the
right.
goal is to not avoid them.
Crazy uncle. Yeah, I had a crazy uncle in my family. I mentioned it to one of my cousins recently in a WhatsApp. She didn't respond as though she might have thought I was criticizing him. It was kind of like, it was always problematic. Is every family, not every family, but a lot of families have a crazy uncle. So, you know, it could be a grandpa or grandma or cousin or something. So, to use it as a situation to enhance your patience and compassion and so forth. Also, one of the classic examples in the Tibetan text, when it talks about oppressed by great suffering, talks about leprosy. So nowadays, well, maybe not so much now, but maybe a decade ago before, if someone had AIDS, remember there was a time when people were afraid you wouldn't want to get near someone with AIDS for fear you might get it. And then different people showed that, I think Princess Diana and different people, took care of them, showed that that was not something, you're thinking that that's bad to be with them, that their juju will rub off on you or something like that. That was kind of one of the classic Tibetan takes on that experiencing great suffering. But it can be just humiliation, someone losing their job or whatever. Okay. Yes. That's who. I can't see who that is. Yeah.
There I go. Okay, Susie. Is that who you mean?
Yeah.
I want to make sure that I know my limits, though, in terms of whom I can really interact with. I think there are some times when I have to distance myself because I haven't gotten to the level of practice. Like if I were to meet a certain politician in person, I would leave because I wouldn't be able to say anything useful.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean you have to interact with everyone. If there are people on the street who are shouting slogans and threatening, for you to come up and try to interact with them may not be the most skillful thing, unless you were really skillful. You might just instigate them. There are examples of what was that girl? There was that one classic photo not so long ago of the policemen with their rifles out, and she's in a beautiful dress and holding a flower.
Mm-hmm.
That can be transformative, but in general, it may not be the best thing to interact with those people, but to feel, to have empathy for all of them.
Yeah.
What's the famous Christian thing, verse, thus, but by the grace of God, though
I. Go by, yeah.
I remember when I was studying in physics in university, there was one, I complained about one lecturer to my, to some brilliant other lecturer, and he was a fundamental Christian, and he said, yes, thus, but by the grace of God, go I, sort of agreeing that this other lecturer who was sort of like, not the same caliber, but we know all of the situations that we might find unpleasant, we ourselves have acted in that way in some lives, many lives in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We've created what the Buddha said were the five actions of immediate retribution. We've created, mm-hmm. you know, unspeakable horrors. It's just, as someone was saying before, when we were talking about whether someone was evil or low quality or something, all of this changes over time. But there is a certain segments of our existence where there is a continuity of our recent behavior that affects us by what a life we're born into, what karma's ripening in our immediate situation, mm-hmm. and so forth. So, yeah, to recognize that and to have compassion for them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. So, how are we doing? Okay. Anyone else have a itch they want to scratch? Okay.
I have a quick question, maybe just not to derail this too far down the political path, but, you know, obviously with everything being so polarized right now, I think the area I struggle with the most is finding that balance between, you know, avoiding people. For example, it's easy. I don't, you know, try not to watch Fox News as an example. That's a pretty easy action for me to take. I'm not inundating myself in that. But more difficult for me is that if I have, you know, family members or friends or acquaintances or other people that I might not agree with their viewpoint, and finding that line between sort of just cutting them out of my life and still looking at them in a way that, you know, to remember that, you know, we had a great relationship or wholesome relationship before it became apparent that we don't agree, you know, politically or whatever the case is. And so finding that balance between avoiding where it disturbs me, knowing that they feel a certain way I don't agree with versus, you know, so I don't agitate myself, but also on the other hand, you know, still applying compassion toward them, I guess. I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, that's not easy. There's a Dharma center in Asheville. I'm north of Asheville here, you know, or in Asheville, North Carolina. It's a Kargyu center. And I'm very good friends with the director. He's the one I referred to, I think, earlier. His name is Han Lai. He's Chinese Malaysian, but he's very erudite, speaks English perfectly. He got his PhD at University of Virginia and studied with Jeffrey Hopkins and everything. So there's one student there that we both know who's helps me a lot. He drives an Uber. He's taken me around sometime when I've been in Asheville and taken me to the hospital and stuff. But he's a big fan of these conspiracy theories. And so my friend, the director of the center there, you know, we kind of chuckle about that. It gives us an opportunity to practice patience without offending him. Unfortunately, I've acted unskillfully recently with one of my neighbors who was on the phone with me telling me all these conspiracy theories. I said, don't tell me about all of this stuff anymore. And he hung up and he only outreach in the last couple of months has been when there were when three dogs attacked a deer on my lawn and the police came out and shot the deer, quote, to put it out of its misery. And he called me up just to see if I was being attacked or something. But yeah, you have to be very careful not to offend people. Okay, good. So let's go on. So the next verse, verse 5, Rinpoche, Lama Sopa Rinpoche's translation, when out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, insults, or the like, I accept defeat and offer the victory to them. Actually, the Tibetan is quite clear. It says, to the others, Gelka Shenla Buagi Buarlava, I will train to offer the victory to the others. Well, you can say them means the others. So there are two takes on this verse. One is referring to it as this particular kind of situation when you're abused, puts the emphasis on that and how to react to that. And another take is just the act of accepting defeat and giving the victory to other, which kind of segues into the practice of Tonglen. Remember, did we mention the word Tonglen before? No? You know, Tonglen is a practice that Atisha popularized as he brought to Tibet. Tonglen are Tibetan words. Tongwa means to give. Lenpa means to take. So it could be, if you just said giving and taking, you might understand different things. What it means is taking on the suffering of other sentient beings onto yourself, seeing the disadvantages of self-cherishing, and giving to others your good qualities, your, you know, imagining transferring to them your virtuous karma, your good qualities, your body, your possessions, as a way of training the mind in love and compassion. Compassion is the mind that wants others to be free of suffering. So out of compassion, imagine taking on their suffering and putting it onto your self-cherishing thought, which helps to erode it, because always wants to avoid problems for oneself. And then out of love, wanting others to be happy and wanting to give them happiness, imagine giving them your virtues, your body, in whatever way, whether it's as a servant, as a friend, as a nurse, even as food. And, you know, cherishing them more than oneself. So various things. So basically this is talking about how to deal with people who harm you in a way that may not be justified at all. There's a verse in the Guru Puja that some of you may recite in the glance meditation at the end of that puja. I find very, very good. You know what a glance meditation is? Do you know what that means? Panoramic meditation. It means, especially on the Lan Rim, it means to one verse on each of the important points of the practice. It might be in Tantra or something else, but here in the Lan Rim, a verse on guru devotion, a verse on the value of the life of leisure and endowment of perfect human rebirth and impermanence, a verse on the suffering of the lower realms and taking refuge, and, you know, different things like this. So there's a verse there that goes, Kamsum Kegu Malu Drogirte. So if all the beings of the three realms were to get angry with me, Sheshing Sangduk Jikshik Sokchokyang, get angry with me, abuse, expose my faults, threaten or even kill me. Kamsu Geger Malu Drugite Sheshing Sangduk Jikshik Mituk Nolan Pempa Jukchepe Sopar please bless me to complete the perfection of patience by responding to their harm by offering benefit. You know, even if so they abuse me. Here, this one is talking about abusing when out of envy, others mistreat me. So that means you didn't really deserve this. They were envious of you or something like that. So if others harm us in these various ways, they get angry at us, they abuse us, mistreat us in various ways, you know, say bad things. If they were to expose our faults, like in the 37 practices of the Buddhist sons, a couple of the verses say about if others right in the marketplace point us out and tell and say to everyone else all of our faults, we should, you know, thank them and bow and say, you were right, you know, thank you for pointing out my faults, rather than indignantly arguing and so forth. Even if they threaten or kill me, in response to that, rather than the usual response is to, you know, worldly wisdom is to respond with abuse back or harm back. Instead of that, to respond to their harm by bringing them benefit. So one of the exemplifications of that that I remember, and I mentioned in the other teachings also, was that Geshe Rapton, who was one of my teachers, who was one of the debating partners of the Dalai Lama, present Dalai Lama, Geshe Rapton, who started the monastery in Switzerland, and a lot of the Western Sangha went there for a long time, studied, you know, deep philosophical subjects. Geshe Rapton was this incomparable teacher. When he was young at Sergey, he would, you know, he was a great scholar, a practitioner. He was making, in between sessions, he was making prostrations, collecting merit, trying to realize emptiness and everything. And other people, out of jealousy, would talk about him behind his back, criticizing him, you know, it's natural out of jealousy. And when he heard about that, he took these kinds of teachings to heart, and he invited those individuals to his little room where he prepared Tibetan momos. You know what momos are? The steamed dumplings? Yeah. What's her name? I can't see her name here. Someone just gave thumbs up and hit those momos. So not, you know, not sort of condescendingly saying, oh, thanks so much for abusing me here. You know, nothing like that. Completely out of appreciation, because they'd, it's understood that when others talk about us behind our back, they don't even say in front of us, but they talk about us behind our back. That's one of the strongest ways of purifying negative karma. If you don't respond with anger, you can feel some gratitude that some immense amount of negative karma has been ripened in that way. So I sometimes, even though this verse is talking about not responding to those and to accept the defeat and give the victory to others, because of Langri Tampa's, the motivating factor for him studying this was that line, I will accept the defeat and give the victory to the other. I like to put that part first. I will practice to accept defeats and offer the victory to others, such as when abused by others out of jealousy, rather than putting the emphasis on that particular kind of thing. So it can be extended to all other kinds of things. I remember when I first was at Copan in the 70s, and irritated, you know, India was, for me, was kind of, and Nepal, kind of irritating in general, and I would get angry. And I remember Lama Sopa Rinpoche advising, oh, it's good to accept the defeat and give the victory to others. I don't think I was worthy at that time of that, you know, sage advice, but I remember him mentioning. So I will practice to accept defeats and offer the victory to others, such as, because in the Tibetan here it says, Dakla Shengi Kaktoki Sherkir Lasok Mi Rikpe, that the Lasok means and so forth, or such as. So when it's not talking about that, just that one kind of thing when abused by others out of jealousy, but whenever we're abused or people get angry with us, expose our faults, all of these different things, threaten or kill us, take away our money, our home or whatever, rather than responding with anger, to practice this particular kind of patience, giving us an opportunity of practicing that. And not just so generally when we talk about patience, there are different divisions of patience. One of them is the patience of not retaliating harm. So that's what's talked about here. But here, even the Theravada practitioners practice that, not to retaliate. You find in the Dharmapada, the verses from the Buddha that in the Theravada canon also, when others abuse you, not to abuse back. When others harm you, not to harm back. When others steal from you, not to steal from them, so forth. But here, the Bodhisattva practice goes beyond that and actually benefit them to actively try to, in the terms here, offer the victory to others, or in the verse from the Guru Puja, to respond to their harm by bringing about benefit for them. So that might be, in certain circumstances, that might be kind of difficult, but it's something to aspire to. Maybe in certain circumstances it's not so difficult if you can see some kind of tangible examples of that, you know, like Geshe Rapton's offering the momos to the people who were talking about him, criticizing him behind his back. Okay? Make sense? Let me read you a little from Chekhova's commentary. Remember, in this book that Thupten Jinpa authored, he has Geshe Chekhova's, anyway, Thupten Jinpa's translation of Geshe Chekhova's commentary on these verses. So Geshe Chekhova, remember, he didn't meet Langri Tongpa. He was inspired. He received the teachings from one of his gurus. He sought out Langri Tongpa, found out that he had passed away, sought out one of the main disciples of Langri Tongpa, to whom he asked this question about, what about the verse that says accept the defeat and offer the victory to others? That's what motivated him to write this commentary and also to write the 7-point training of the mind. That's the classic, long, much longer, elaborate version of Atisha's mind training. So here he says, so the way Thupten Jinpa translates it, when others out of jealousy treat me wrongly with abuse and slander, I will train to take upon myself the defeat and offer to others the victory. I'm just always changing the words a little bit, but it's the same sense. Whether or not, this is Geshe Chekhova's commentary, whether or not we are at fault, if others slander us or malign us out of jealousy or other motives, not just jealousy, instead of harboring resentment, we should respond with a gentle mind. Free of resentment, we should refrain from claiming, for instance, I'm innocent, others are to blame. Like Langri Tongpa, we should take the defeat upon ourselves. It is said that whenever misfortunes befell another, he would say, that's Langri Tongpa, I too am in him. Maybe that's like, thus by the grace of God go I, right? I too am in him. When we engage in charity and ethical discipline at present, we do so to purify our negative karma and accumulate merit. Charity and morality, the first two of the 6 perfections, which are, in a sense, the principal causes of receiving a perfect human rebirth in the future, along with stainless prayer. if we recognize those who slander us as sources of kindness, although this is not a substitute for the aforementioned two activities, charity and morality, it nevertheless cleanses us of resentment and purifies our negative karma. The master said, taking the defeat upon ourselves prevents us from adding to our negative karma. So rather than responding with abuse back, we refrain, and in the Mahayana sense, going beyond that to actually benefit them. Langrikamba stated, when it comes to purifying negative karma and accumulating merit, it is more effective to recognize those who baselessly slander you as great sources of kindness. It's more beneficial than to offer buttery delicacies to every monk in a place called Penyu. And the Bodhisattvacharyavatara states, since it is in dependence upon his malign intention that forbearance arises, the patience arises in us, it is really he who is the enemy is the cause of my patience, my forbearance. Like the true Dharma, he is worthy of veneration. I don't know if you catch the implication there. Generally, we think of kindness as having been derived from some motivation. Someone is kind because they wanted to help us. If someone harms us, ordinary people generally don't see that as kind, even if it gives us, someone hits us with their car and we get a big check from the insurance company, we still don't generally say that person is kind, right? But you can kind of say, oh, they were kind, in a sense. From the Dharma perspective, if someone benefits you, and in this sense helps to purify negative karma, by abusing you, they are kind. And in that sense, the last line here, it said that even the Dharma is kind. Generally, you say, how can the Dharma be kind? The Dharma is just either truth or, true cessation or the true path. How can that be kind? Because it benefits us. We pay veneration to the Dharma, we say that the Dharma is kind. It's kind of hard for a Westerner to get our minds around that, right? So the last line here, like the true Dharma, it is worthy of veneration. So even enemies who give us this opportunity to practice patience, who benefit us in this way, they help to purify our negative karma. Since it is in dependence upon his malign intention that in forbearance arises, it is really he who is the cause of forbearance. The enemy is the cause of my patience, and therefore, like the true Dharma, he is worthy of veneration. To substantiate this assertion, Shantideva states in the following that forbearance, patience, is more powerful than ethical discipline. Famous verse, there is no negativity like anger, and there is no virtue like forbearance. That's not the only place, Shantideva is not the only place you find that. The Buddha said that in many of his discourses. Because anger is the most destructive of klesha, delusions, afflictions, its antidote, patience or forbearance, is the greatest of virtues. There's no virtue like forbearance. This presents the forbearance of being unperturbed by harms. So not the patience of not retaliating, being unperturbed by harms. was something else I wanted to say about that. Let me see if I can remember. When out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, insults, or the like. I will accept the defeat and offer the victory to them. Yeah. Okay. That's more or less. Anyone have a thought about that, Shwargana? How are you doing? You flagging? Did you have a little coffee? Tea in your break time? Okay.
I have a question, Venerable George.
Yes.
So when I read this verse, it's lovely, and I see the benefits of it intellectually, but actually put that into practice,
yeah.
I mean, that's just, I mean, not that I won't try, I'll definitely try, but, you know, just when you experience someone, especially if you feel it's unjustified, like, what tools can you use to help you maintain your patience in that point?
Well, familiarity. You know, I like to say to practice in the laboratory of your mind. On your meditation cushion, you can even bring up these kinds of situations, either things that have happened to you or are happening to you. And in the laboratory of your mind, you can perform these great experiments to see if you can generate a mind of patience and the thought to how to benefit them in return for their harm. Without practicing first, without familiarizing yourself with it, first of all, it's very difficult to actualize on the fly, so to speak, you know, while it's actually happening to you. It's like the example I've given before. I think I've even given this example before. If Robbie and Don Brown and I all join the military reserve and we're in basic training, and instead of learning how to fire the weapons or the missile system and everything, the gun and the tank, where I'm watching DVDs or reading comic books or something like that. So when the actual battle comes on, we're in the tank, and Robbie says, put the shell in, shoot. And I say, shell, where are the shells? How do I, you know, at that point, to learn the manual, you know, on the fly, that's what basic training is about, right? So this is like our basic training in meditation, to bring up examples of situations like this, things that may have happened to you in the past or happening now, imagining what could happen, and trying to rehearse good things rather than rehearsing anger. Like I said before, the Dalai Lama told Richard Gere, don't rehearse, you know, anger. We can rehearse these virtuous qualities, imagine how to respond to them, what we could imagine possibly doing. Then when a situation like that arises, we have some training to call on. That's why I like to think that's kind of like basic training. Yes, Sister Diana.
Thank you, Venerable George.
I wanted to...
Oh, your voice went down suddenly.
Okay, sorry.
You have to get the microphone.
I wanted to offer something that was maybe the only occasion that I have not been hooked into the situation of continuing to argue with somebody. And maybe this will be of some use as people are having family gatherings approaching. I was in a situation where there was an in-law who loved to argue aggressively. He said that getting angry was a delight, something to be sought out. And he did this with everybody, and he did it with me, and I knew that it would perpetuate an unforgivable schism if I kept when he said something that I knew was factually false, saying, no, that's not true, and here's how we know. In other settings, it might be right to give that information, but it wasn't there. And the situations that are ripe for hooking us are like Groundhog Day. They're the ones where it's the same thing over and over again. So in, as Venerable George has beautifully advised us to prep this on our meditation cushions, you could write the script for those situations. So write the script, but devise a different response and practice that beforehand. And you only have to practice saying it one more time than the other person tries to offer you the hook again. And then they stop. And I did this. This was maybe the only time in my life I've been able to do this. And after like the seventh time I didn't respond, I saw his shoulders drop. I saw his face change. And I became the only person in the extended family he didn't argue with. And that lasted the rest of his life.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, you can do this. The fact that it happens again and again gives you the information you need to, in advance, plan the words and the facial expression and the voice you will use instead, because we can't not do something. We can only do something else instead. Thank you, Venerable. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's good sage words. So, yeah, it's kind of like, I mentioned, I'll get to you, Barbara, in a second. So I mentioned in the beginning that, I gave a talk to a elder group in Asheville recently, maybe it was there, that the meaning of meditation, Maitreya, the future Buddha, who gave teachings directly to a Sangha, he wrote in one of his texts, the meaning of meditation, the definition of meditation is to familiarize the mind with a wholesome activity, a wholesome object that is something that will benefit you, like meditating on emptiness and compassion or beneficial activity. So one doesn't have to think of it as divorced from Buddhist practice, you know, rehearsing or making, like you said, making a script. That's familiarizing yourself. This is how I could respond to those activities. This is actually, rather than familiarizing yourself with negativity, which was one of the causes of the delusions. Remember, familiarity, kind of meditating on the delusion so that it becomes so frequent, it comes up naturally. Familiarizing yourself with virtuous responses is the way of the Buddhist practitioner, especially the Bodhisattva. Okay. Oh yeah. So Barbara, you had a question, a comment also.
This is what I do when people seem to confront me or I feel confronted. I offer it just, and I don't. Venerable George can tell us if it's a Buddhism way, but the number one thing I do is I don't take it personally. To me, I could be that in that state in a future or past life, or even in this life at some point. So I feel like they're suffering, and I have compassion towards their suffering. And then I lean toward, I reach out in ways that we have in common to find ways of communicating and being together in a amiable way if possible. And then find something in them that I admire or can learn from, or even if it's tiny. One time it was a very confronted person at work, and I found out she saved a possum when she was young, a baby possum, and kept it in her pocket for weeks.
Oh.
And that made us jump the hurdle.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Sage words, both. Anyone else had something they wanted to add?
Okay. Oh, Donna. Sister Donna.
Yeah. I had a question.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay. Hi. Hi, Venerable George, it's Laura.
Oh, hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm going kind of backwards to last night.
Okay.
So with the equanimity and exchanging self for others, and then Tonglen today. So Tonglen, I thought, was exchanging self for others, but I'm kind of missing a little bit of the exchanging self for others last night. Because when it comes to Tonglen, personally, you know, I can do that exchange with a stranger. Doesn't mean they're higher or lower, just that they're suffering, and exchange my happiness for their suffering. But when it came to last night, I'm kind of missing applying that in general to whether somebody's lower or higher. So could you help me with that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. So you're kind of grappling with these different terms, equalizing and exchanging self and others, and Tonglen, kind of asking, in a sense, what's the relationship? And then another question is whether it's applicable to people of different levels, lower than you spiritually or equal or above, something like that.
Kind of. Right, because personally for me with Tonglen, it's, lack of a better word, easier, because they're a stranger. I know they're suffering. I'm not applying really any skills. It's just a wish. Whereas with the exchanging self with others, that's where I need a little bit of help there.
So my understanding is that the practice that brings about the ability to do giving and taking, let's say taking and giving, because generally it's said that you begin by taking the suffering of others. Otherwise, they won't be in a state to be able to enjoy what you want to offer to them. So we say, even though that tong means giving, say giving and taking, is taking and giving. To be able to do that, you have to have some strength of mind. And that comes about because of seeing, first of all, the equality between self and others. That is to say, even this one statement, the Dalai Lama has said many times, this alone is enough to recognize our equality with others. And that being, we all want to be happy, and we all want to be free of suffering. Or as in the Lama Chopa, the Guru Puja verse, gets it even in more detail. It says, how's it come? No one wants even the slightest suffering between myself and others. No one wants to have even the slightest of suffering, and no one is satisfied with the happiness they have. So this is going beyond, everyone wants to be free of suffering. So no, everyone wants to be free of even the smallest suffering. And like us, we're exactly the same. We'd like everything to be good all the time. And we're never, not only do we want happiness, but we're never satisfied with the happiness we have. What that means is, as I mentioned before, of the faults of samsaric happiness, one of them are the good things of samsara, the things that we think of as good, like pleasure and so forth. They don't bring real satisfaction. They're always the case of reducing one suffering and replacing it with another. And while the bigger suffering is going down, and the lower suffering is getting higher, while it's still in that situation, we find that relief. We call that pleasure. Ah. And when the other suffering gets a little bit higher, you know, like I mentioned in New York and Washington a couple of weeks ago, there's a commercial on TV right now for apartments.com, I think it is, with Jeff, was it Bloomberg, the guy who played in Jurassic Park and
Goldblum.
Was it?
Goldblum, Jeff Goldblum.
Goldblum, yeah. So there's these two girls on the patio of their present house, and they're fanning themselves so hot, and the flies are falling onto their computer, and they're saying, "Oh, how nice it would be to have air conditioning." You know, they're in heat, and the flies are falling in such a way that it takes them to apartments.com and finds them an apartment with air conditioning. And then the next scene, they're saying, "Oh, this is so much better, isn't it?" And they're both shivering underneath the air conditioner. This is what's called changeable suffering, right? What at the first moment they went into that new apartment, maybe that was pleasure, but it eventually they recognized that the air conditioner, and even Jeff Goldblum is also, as he's narrating, this is also shivering. If you get a chance to see that, you can think, oh, this is a good one. I want to see this again. This is talking about changeable suffering. So,
One thing before we move on, just a student over on YouTube mentioned in the chat there that it's in the case of being in a dangerous or abusive relationship that there's wisdom to take into that idea of forbearance and not to stay in a dangerous situation.
Yeah. We know from terminology of Western psychology, what is it called when you put up with a partner's abusive behavior? What is that called?
Enabling.
Enabling. Is that, there's some other, I thought there was some other term. So it doesn't mean that you have to put up with any kind of abusive behavior. Sometimes leave, you know, what it's talking about is your own personal development to be able to be patient doesn't mean that you just perpetuate and enable someone to do something that would be wrong, but your response, your mental response is not to engage in anger where the mind becomes agitated and unclear. Those are kind of defining characteristics of klesha, like the horse's hooves causing the water to be agitated and the mud to come up. So when the mind becomes agitated, you can no longer make a proper decision. Your wisdom is clouded. Your mind is, many thoughts are coming, so you need to calm down a little bit and to practice patience. So that doesn't mean that you don't act decisively. You can still leave if someone is abusive, maybe find a shelter or like in the 37 practices that I'm not sure if they put it up on YouTube. If you want to see, you can take a look. The Shantideva Center and the Guhya Samaja Center, we taught that text, a weekend seminar. I'm not sure if it last week or 2 weeks ago has all merged into one now. One of the quintessential practices of the Bodhisattva is to leave home. So because of the fact in the home, in your home city, in your town, whatever, companions and family that you have attachment to constrain you, and also can cause you to be to have arguments because of your affection for them or their affection for you or clinging and so forth. And there are arguments that perpetuate for a long time. So it's the practice of the bodhisattvas to leave home. So that can mean various things. In one sense, it can mean the long journey going into isolation to meditate, to practice Dharma, or it can mean just isolating your mind from those things. I remember reading a book many years ago. I think Aldous Huxley, I don't know if any of you are literary types, called The Journey to the East. I think they even made a movie of it in the 50s or 60s, a black and white movie. So the kind of idea is, you know, like the great trip to the Orient or to India, you know, that's like the Beatles or something like that, you know, changing your life. So there's a certain logic to that. So if you're in an abusive situation, you can kind of see it like that bodhisattva practice to remove yourself from that. Being patient doesn't mean not doing anything. It means not getting angry. Does that make sense? Now, I was going to say something else before, but I think I'd lost the thread of it before anyway. So let me go on, introduce the next verse, because tomorrow, the last verse, the eighth verse, we'll spend a little more time on, even though it might seem simple, because it's about, it has some subtleties in that. So we'll have, if we can get through part of the sixth verse today, we'll have more time tomorrow for that verse on emptiness and eight worldly dharmas and so forth. So the sixth verse in Lama Sopa Rinpoche's translation is, when someone whom I have benefited and in whom I have great hope gives me terrible harm, I regard them as my virtuous friend. I think Rinpoche is trying to put a positive, the last word of the Tibetan is lap, which means train. So it's, I will train. The original version of the eight verses had the word shok, may I. Here, Rinpoche even sort of straddles that, says, I regard them as my virtuous friends. So the way that I think of that is, when someone I have benefited and in whom I have great hopes treats me unjustly, as the Tibetan says, shintu mirik. Mirik means unjustified. You know, they treat you in harm in a way that you're not deserving of. Maybe the other translations get that. Rinpoche seems to leave that out. Gives me terrible harm. I will train to see them, view them as my shenyen dampa. Shenyen means friend, generally. It can mean virtuous friend. Like, for instance, you know the word geshe? We talk geshe la at the center. Geshe is short for gewe shenyen. Shenyen here is the word that's here, this friend. Gewa means virtuous. So geshe is short for virtuous friend, or gewe shenyen. It's the word kaliya mitra in Sanskrit that is sort of a synonym for the guru, the spiritual teacher, someone who's not like the bad friend of the six causes of the delusions, but virtuous friend, you know, someone that you can emulate, who can teach you. So I will practice to see them as my shenyen dampa, my holy friend. This is maybe even more strong, kind of like gewe shenyen, sort of like geshe or virtuous friend. Here is my holy friend. Here, Rinpoche says virtuous friend, but it's, the word is not virtuous. It's dampa, which means like, well, when we talk about the Dharma, we call dampe chö, the holy Dharma or the supreme Dharma. You know that word in Sanskrit, the sad-dharma, as opposed to the worldly dharmas, the eight worldly dharmas. So this is like the holy friend. So what's the meaning here? So here's another kind of problematic situation. when you have nurtured someone, maybe you've taken them in, you've given them a job, you've taught them, you've tried to, maybe they're your child or a friend or something, and at some point they do something to harm you. Maybe they've stolen your checkbook or your car or something like that, or they've harmed you in some way. They post on their Facebook page. Maybe they defriend you or they say bad things about you. So this is a kind of individual who you have a certain expectation, having helped them and benefited in them some way, that they will treat you always with respect and remember your kindness. When instead of that, they do the opposite and they harm you without justification, this is another one of these problematic situations. So Langri Tangpa, Geshe Langri Tangpa is saying here, to view them as your holy friend or your guru, in other words, you view them as your guru. So the sense of this is that it's similar to what we were saying before, in the very same kind of way of thinking, they're giving you an opportunity to practice patience because you were expecting kindness and they treated you exactly opposite. And you kind of expected kindness because you've been so kind to them, to see them not only as giving you a chance to practice patience, but recognizing them as your guru because they have helped you to purify negative karma. There's no way that their harm that they've given you could arise unless you created the karma for it in the past. That's one of the quintessential important points to think about karma when we talk about there's no way of experiencing a result without having created the cause. You know the 4 points of karma? I think Robbie does. Robbie, what are the 4 general points of karma when you meditate on karma? You must have taught Lan Rin Meijin. You're muted still.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Karma is definite.
Definite.
Karma expands over time.
Expandable.
You can't experience the cause without the effect.
You can't experience the effect without the having created the cause. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Let's see. Karma is not lost.
Perfect. Oh, man. He's deserving of that title. So karma is definite. Doesn't mean that if you create karma, it definitely rises. It means if you create virtue, you definitely experience something pleasurable, even though it's samsaric pleasure. If you create negativity, you will experience something suffering, unpleasant. Karma is expandable, so even small deeds left in your mind stream over time, they will naturally increase in intensity, and even from a very small negative action, great suffering can arise. So that's the advice of that, the consequence of that is not to create even small negative karma. And there's no way to experience a result without having created the cause. So that's the one that we're talking about here. Whatever happens to us that's unpleasant, always to keep that in mind, that the other person or situation or the government or whatever we're thinking of as the cause of our harm, they're only a cooperative condition, like the arrow and the target. I said, and unless we created the cause in the past, we shot the arrow, we created the negative karma, even the target's there. If the no arrow was shot in the past, if we didn't create the negative karma, there's no way that we would experience that as suffering. Like the example of people in the airplane that crashes, and 211 of them die, and two people survive, or one person survives. You've heard stories like that, right? Some amazing thing. So we understand that as people that have created in unison some karma in the past to experience the plane crash, but they've created some negative karma in the past collectively, to, negative karma that experiences that way. But one or two or more of them opted out of the final result. They didn't rejoice in the activity. Maybe they were breaking windows or stealing or something like that, or killing or destroying. And someone in the course of that, they have some collective karma to experience the whole event, but they didn't culminate in the final action, maybe of killing an animal, a dog or something like that. They all chased it together, and then at the last minute someone said, oh no, don't kill it, and then other people killed it. So unless you've created the cause, there's no way that you can experience a result. So that has many ramifications. If we want to experience the result of happiness, Stephanie, I'll get to you in a second. If you want to experience the result of happiness, you have to create the cause of happiness. So one of the ways of doing that is to offer to the gurus, you know, to the Buddha, to the omniscient mind, even if it's in visualization, offer flowers and water to bathe in, water to drink, water to rinse the mouth, water to cool. I often think of my mini split, you know, cool, moist air coming, offering to the Buddhas flowers and incense and lamps, perfume, delicious food of, you know, tremendous flavors like the gods, and enchanting music that actually teaches the Dharma from various musical instruments and so forth. Offering different things like that, you create the offering, you know, experience of great bliss and the experience of emptiness, as in Tantra, creating the cause to experience those things oneself. So there's no way that this harm that another who you've nurtured that could come to you unless you created the cause. So instead of getting angry, to keep that in mind. And the last thing is, karma is never lost, in the sense that unless it's destroyed by anger or by regret, karmic seeds remain in our mind stream. So Stephanie, you wanted to...
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you well.
Okay, good, good. Thank you, Venerable George. This has been wonderful. I think for Westerners, for myself, let me say for myself, right? I think when I hear the term creating the cause, and for victims of violence or abuse, that's a hard thing to, it triggers a gross misunderstanding of the term creating the cause. And I was wondering if you could speak to that, or even if you, did you understand my question?
I think so.
Okay.
And I'm not sure exactly what point you're getting at. Like, for instance, I've mentioned in one of the other courses when I taught Elder Hostel in California sometime, many of the people who had come to Land of Medicine Buddha were Jewish. And there was always some question, because they didn't know much about Buddhism. They would come I'd give a talk in the Gompa about Buddhism. They'd always ask about the Holocaust, you know, how did this happen? And I unskillfully, I told it as it was. I mean, there's no way that they could experience these great sufferings unless collectively in the past they had created the cause of this, you know, harming others. Doesn't mean that this life at all, probably, certainly, almost impossible that karma can ripen the same life unless you create very, very heavy karma with respect to your parents or your gurus. Sometimes it says karma that you create with your parents when you're young can ripen when you're older this lifetime, because of their kindness, they're very heavy objects of karma, or your gurus, but making offerings and practicing, devoting oneself to the spiritual friend, that karma can ripen this lifetime. But general karma that we experience now, ripening, has to have been created many, many, many lifetimes ago. But that was not received very well by these people. I said, I may not have been the right, to say exactly like that. So sometimes if people are being abused, if you were to say that you created the cause, they might think earlier this lifetime that I created the cause, or sometime before this, can mean it means previous lifetimes that we have created the cause. So, yeah. So what is that? Yeah. Okay. Thumbs up. Okay. Yes. I don't see the name. Oh, there it is. Naga.
I feel like the more I see it as these anger behaviors coming into our circle, I feel it's like a Mara keeps surfacing, but then somewhere you have to be strong enough to say you are stronger than that. You can say no to this anger or people who are. So it's also like Pema Chodron says, nothing lives until you learn. So coming to overcome the anger or meeting these behaviors, you have to overcome, power up to say no. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I agree. So like the Buddha under the Bodhi tree on the night that he, historically said to have achieved enlightenment. So he was already very close to enlightenment. From the Buddha, Mahayana point of view, Shakyamuni had achieved enlightenment many eons before. His whole life, being born as a prince and being precocious and leaving home and meditating and everything, all of this was the demonstration of the 12 deeds of the Buddhas, to lead others in proclaiming, turning the wheel of Dharma. So, but in that episode under the Bodhi tree, he was accosted by fearful beings, Maras, who were, trying to, harm him in various ways with weapons and so forth. And he meditated on patience without, he said no to the Maras, so to speak. Then they appeared very cleverly as beguiling goddesses, the daughters of the Devaputra, the head of the Maras. There's one kind of Mara called Devaputra Mara. Do you know who that is, Naga? Devaputra Mara. So some of the god realm or asura realm, very powerful beings that have malevolent intention. Actually, the real Mara, the most important Maras are the Maras of our delusions. But there are external Maras also, evil people that can harm us and spirits and so forth. So the Buddha meditated on impermanence. Shakyamuni meditated. Well, he wasn't Buddha yet. He was just about to become Buddha. He meditated on impermanence and saw them as they would be as they grew older, no longer attractive and beguiling, trying to tempt him from kind of evil, like the sense of the evil friend wanting you to say, oh, why meditate? Come here, play with us. Kind of like the sirens, right? of Ulysses and so forth that attracted the men from the shore as they were in the ships and, oh, come here. And they would turn into beasts that would devour them or harm them in some way. So, yeah, the Buddha said no to them also. But it's not just saying no, it's using your mind to meditate, meditating on impermanence, meditating on love and compassion, and then extricating yourself from that situation on the basis of that.
Venerable George, may I add a comment to the...
Yes, of course.
the person's comment about abuse, you know, in this lifetime. I think one of the challenges is the matter of fact that the slang use of karma, which is, you know, that's your karma. And it's almost said with a, not necessarily us, but it's almost said with a tone of blaming.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I think that's one of the things that when we talk with people and we do talk about karma, especially when there's trauma, is to be so careful that there's kind of, to avoid any kind of sense of blame, because I think that's often how the word karma is used.
Yeah, maybe used, yeah, maybe used that way by worldly people, but the sense here, when we use the karma, we think of it as our responsibility rather than blaming. It, certainly you shouldn't, you should never point at others and say that's your karma, unless you're counseling them in the same sense, you know, that take responsibility. Don't blame the other person for your problems. Recognize that this is a result of your past karma. That's not a blame, because we all have on our mind stream karmic seeds that were deposited in lifetimes, you know, immensely distant in the past, that are only, the only thing that is preventing them ripening is the right cooperative condition. Like, I'm sure I have the karma to be born as a velociraptor in my mind stream. But because there are no velociraptor embryo, or, you know, egg and sperm that are about to come together that my mind stream could enter into right now. So because that cooperative condition hasn't arisen, that seed hasn't ripened. So we all have within our mind stream karmic seeds. That's one of the other reasons for avoiding putting yourself in situations where karma could ripen, rather than walking down a dangerous, you know, in a dangerous neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, with your cash box or dressed in seductive clothing or something like that. That's putting yourself into a situation where negative karma could ripen. So better to avoid, you know, gambling dens or, you know, situations like this, or the Proud Boys rallies or things like that. Probably better to avoid those so that your negative karma doesn't ripen. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. So let me just say another thought of this, the sixth verse. Tomorrow we're going to go, we'll finish this sixth verse and go to the seventh and eighth verses. When someone I have benefited and in whom I have great hopes or expectation, that's generally what we say, you know, I've scratched your back, so you should, I expect you're going to scratch mine, right? I've helped you. When someone I've benefited and whom I have great hopes gives me unjustified harm, very unjustified, Shintu Mirik, Rinpoche says terrible harm. It's the sense here is that it's unjustified. There's no, you didn't do anything bad to deserve this. I will practice to view them as my holy friend, because they're giving me the chance to see this as the ripening of my negative karma, and not only see it that way, to recognize my negative karma has gone down tremendously. It's like when we were abused in the previous verse, unjustly. It's one of the powerful ways to purify negative karma, that it can ripen. And it gives us a chance to practice patience. So instead of seeing them as an object of anger and, you know, holding a grudge for a long time, to recognize them as having benefited us. One of my Dharma acquaintances over the years was a lady in New York City. I think Diana remembers her, who had come to visit me at Sarah J. she had gone to a yoga class with John Campbell, who taught yoga in New York City. And John was a friend, and he said, go see George at Sarah. So she was out, she had, from New York, dressed in, you know, Western clothes, she was on the bus driving out to Bella Coopie from Mysore. And the bus driver was inebriated and had fallen asleep, and the bus crashed. He died. He was decapitated. Most of the passengers, if not all, were gravely injured. She smashed her head on the metal railing, you know, in the bus, these Indian buses, they're kind of rudimentary. And she was unconscious. Trucks came. Some people put her on the back of a truck, brought her to the hospital where they tried to put the bones. I visited her in the hospital, and she thought this was an incredibly terrible event. What was her name? Diana, you remember who I'm talking about? Anyway, it'll come to me in a second. So one of the monks from Sarah had come out to her previously and said, oh, you're so lucky. She told me this. She said, this monk is crazy. He said, I'm so lucky that my negative karma had ripened in this way. And she was adamant this was stupid and so terrible and so forth. Some years later, I went to New York, and the Dalai Lama was teaching there, and I saw her. She had, after having surgery in India, she went back to the States. They had to re-break all the bones in her face and reset them. You know how they do. And she looked fine, and she told me, you know, George, this was one of the best experiences of my life. You know. Previously, she said, there's nothing good about this. How stupid this monk was to say that. So in a sense, she had come to see this situation as her guru. It had given her a chance to practice patience and many other good things. Okay.
Venerable George, this is Kim. I was just thinking that, you know, as they say, timing is everything. And so when this
location was everything.
Well,
location.
Too. But, you know, to as happened with her, that she was given information about how this could have been the most wonderful thing in her life when she was in a state of trauma.
Right.
There was no fertile ground at that point because her whole body and mind were involved with trauma. And so, but later, it's like when a wound heals, then there's a time to give a better perspective and understanding of what the whole experience was about. So timing can be everything. And
yes, exactly. Thank you for that. So that's, we can also go back in our meditation over traumas of our life that at the time, and even for a long period of time, maybe even up till the present, have been big roadblocks in our mind, you know, big problems, and reevaluate them from the point of view of Dharma, and sometime, you know, great change. I remember talking about patience to a group in Singapore once at the library there, and mentioned how sometimes you don't know, just saying a kind word about someone who's been your enemy, they hear you talking about them behind the, maybe at a party, there's a bush and you're on one side saying, oh, you know, so-and-so Kim is actually a great person. And you hear that, you thought I didn't like you. And then suddenly you change. She's the person who came to me after the talk said, oh, you know, my husband, we've had this argument for years and years, and this has given me the inspiration to try to change that. So yeah, it's, we can reevaluate the situations of our past in the same way. The time may be right now to look at those situations with the eye of Dharma, with the wisdom eye. Yeah, the wisdom eye is not the like Lhotse Rampa or something, you know, the, some eye up here in the forehead, but it means the eye of wisdom and gnosis. Okay, so let's just do a brief dedication so that we can take advantage of the merit that we created today. Sit comfortably. Relax your body. Relax your mind. Recognize that we've created possibly a great deal of virtuous energy this afternoon, virtuous karma. And of course, we've created virtue in the past, in the present, this year, this life, and in the future. You can imagine all of that virtue. You can dedicate that virtue again and again. It's not like, oh, I dedicated it, so I can't, it's no young, you know, it's already spoken for. You can dedicate it again in such a way that it not ripens simply in some samsaric worldly pleasure alone in the future. It will definitely ripen as something pleasant, but in whatever way it ripens, may become the cause of my continued spiritual development from life to life. May, as a result of this, I develop the mind of bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness, the mind of renunciation, perhaps encounter the teachings of secret mantra, the tantric teachings, but at any rate, quickly, as a result of this, may I achieve higher spiritual states, culminating in enlightenment as a result of these merits for the sake of all living beings. And in particular, at a time like this, as degenerate age as we are, to think, due to these merits, may all of the calamities facing the world now, epidemics, the rise of the delusions and intolerance for one another, may all, as a result of these merits, may these all be quelled, and our fellow brother and sister sentient beings, not just humans, animals, all spirits, the God realms, all find a period of peace again where we can regroup and develop our minds as a result of these merits. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. We'll see you again, those of you who can come tomorrow. I understand that it's tomorrow, right, that Geshe-la's teacher is teaching the foundation of good qualities in the morning. So you might be exhausted from that. But if you have time to join us, if not, hopefully these teachings will be recorded and you could watch later if you don't want to do all day tomorrow. In a marathon with Geshe-la's teacher in the morning and then this in the afternoon. But if you can come, we'll continue. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Venerable George. See you tomorrow.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, Venerable.
Happy thank you,
George.
Thank you, thank you, Venerable George. Thank you, Don.
Bye.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Venerable George.
Thank you, everybody.